Welcome to Crash Concepts, where the economy, energy, and the environment are explored. Up next, fresh ideas and insights into the factors that are driving the world and shaping your future. Presenting information you can't afford to live without, here's Chris Martinson.
Welcome to this Peak Prosperity Podcast. I'm your host, Chris Martinson. Well, here we are, 6 years into the supposed recovery engineered by the Fed, and the only thing we can definitively say about that recovery is that the extremely wealthy got even wealthier, and the bottom quintiles got poorer. Now, this is represented in the media as if it were some strange thing we perhaps ought to study and talk about, as if it were an unexplained light in the northern sky and we were some primitive tribe. Even the Fed professes open puzzlement at this outcome in their testimony, but what actually happened is actually one of the great secrets of our time, only in the sense that very few people know about the way in which the Fed steals money from one set of individuals and gives it to another, all with the complete blessing of the U.S. Congress and Senate. Now, what we're here to talk about today is that this is not some complicated natural mystery, but a well-known artifact of the exact program of financial repression that the Fed has been actively pursuing. The majority has been forced, not asked, forced to give to the few. And the Fed was behind it all with the explicit endorsement of Washington, D.C. To help us make all of this clear today is Dan Ammerman, a chartered financial analyst, author, and speaker with over 30 years of professional financial experience. As an investment banking vice president in the 1980s, he did work in security originations and asset and liability management, including portfolio restructurings for financial institutions, as well as the creation of synthetic securities for institutional clients. He's been a speaker and workshop leader for sponsors, including the Institute for International Research, New York University, and many banking groups. So he's got decades of solid financial expertise. And what caught my eye was an excellent article he wrote that you can find on his website, danielammerman.com, called "Is There a Backdoor Method for the Government to Pay Down the Federal Debt Using Private Savings?" This article really clearly lays out the process of taking from the many, and you really need to understand the process if you want to have any hopes of dodging the process. Now, we've linked to that article and his website at the bottom of the podcast page at peakprosperity.com. Dan, welcome to the program.
Well, thank you, Chris. I sure appreciate you having me.
Well, let's talk about this term I used before, financial repression. Briefly, What is it? Before we get into the mechanisms, just the definition. What's financial repression?
Financial repression sounds like a conspiracy theory.
It does.
I mean, who could really believe that's going on? But this is classic academics. It's very well established. If you want to learn more about financial repression, you do things like you go to the International Monetary Fund website, or you study for a PhD in economics at Harvard or Stanford or a place like that. Financial repression has been around for a very long time. And what it really refers to, bigger picture, is that over the centuries, economies tend to go through cycles of economic liberalization and then repression. Basically, the cycle is the markets liberalize, bubbles build up, there's all sorts of things going on, and the governments step in and they take control, and that becomes the process of financial repression. And the last time we saw a sustained period of financial repression before, somewhere between 2008-2010 is when the latest round began, was between 1945 and somewhere in the early 1970s to late 1970s. It really depends on the nation. But we're in this real predicament right now. If you look at the U.S. national debt, it's roughly equal to the size of the national economy. And one way that I like to look at that to make it more personal is if we take the $17.5 trillion and we divide it by the roughly 97 million households that are above the poverty line on the assumption those are the only ones who could be making real positive contributions, That works out to about $180,000 per household. And that sounds just fantastic. What can possibly be done about it? Well, to understand financial repression, we have to understand we've been there before. Many nations have gone through periods in the past where they have had very high levels of government debt. And there's really four traditional ways of dealing with that. One of them is austerity. Everyone understands that. You raise the tax rates, you lower the government spending. This is a painful choice. It can last for decades. And what do you think the voters think about that, Chris?
Let's ask the people in Greece.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly.
Oh, it's painful.
They riot in the streets.
Oh, it's awful.
There's another option. And this, we could call this the South American option, although that might be a little unfair, Argentina anyway. Mm-hmm. And that is defaulting on government debts. It's radical. Everybody understands it. How do the voters feel about it?
Oh, it's awful.
Nope, they can't. They don't like it at all. Now, there's a third option that I'd say the population as large is not as aware of, but I'm guessing that your audience is, Chris, very much so. And that is rapidly destroying the value of the currency, creating high rates of inflation that very quickly wipe out the true value of the national debt. But that also wipes out the true value of everyone else's savings and salaries and so forth. And it's such an obvious process, you can't really hide it. So how do the voters feel about that?
Well, we don't like it. And I think the Fed tried it and it didn't work. And all they got was inflation without wages going up. So it actually, mm-hmm. it was counterproductive, I think. But I think they were hoping for it or some more of it, and it didn't work. That's how I saw it.
Yeah, well, if the Fed wanted high rates of inflation, we would have high rates of inflation. That's a relatively simple thing for them to do, but that could be a topic for another time.
Okay.
There's a fourth alternative here, because those first three, they all work. They've all been done before. They're all very painful, and it makes the voters very angry.
Well, yeah, let me back up. Let me just say that, yeah, you're right, though. And when inflation gets above a certain level, historically, what we know is that leads to pretty profound political repercussions, usually. If you think of Weimar Germany as one example, or Mexico in 84, or et cetera, there's places where it really does lead to a lot of tumult. And I don't think politicians really like it either very much.
Mm-hmm. Well, and that's the point. They're making the decisions, and I don't mean to be cynical or anything, but are they going to tend to make decisions where they stay in power or where they lose power? And the problem with those first three options of austerity, of default, high rates of inflation, they all really hack off the voters. So there's a very good chance that the people who are in positions of power and privilege and all the wealth that flows from that right now would no longer be in those positions if any of those three were chosen. Now, there's a fourth way of doing this. And again, there is nothing controversial about its existence. It's not the slightest bit controversial for professional economists or people who've studied economics extensively. And it's a process that, you know, as we said, that one of the names for it is financial repression. And there are two key features of this. If you are making decisions as a government official or a Federal Reserve official that are very important, the first one is we know it works. That is what the advanced Western nations did after World War II, and in a process of basically 25 to 35 years, depending on the country, the West went from an average debt as a percentage of national economy from over 90% to under 30%. So we know it works in practice, and we'll get into more detail about how specifically that works. But to understand why this fourth alternative is where governments like to go is that there were no political repercussions. It was actually just as painful for the population as a whole. You got to get the money one way or another. But financial repression is for most people just complex enough that the average voter never gets it. And because they don't get it, they're paying the penalty, but they don't know to assign, they don't know, and they're feeling the penalty because obviously the spending power isn't there, but they don't know who to blame.
Mm-hmm.
So that's really good if you want to stay in office. So when we want to talk about financial repression in the United States, we're talking about Eisenhower. We're talking about Happy Days are here again. We're talking about Leave It to Beaver. Those are the days that we're looking at, and most people don't see those as being times of repression.
Right.
But what was happening the entire time is, as we're about to get into when we look at these techniques here, the American public was on a very deliberate basis having billions of dollars slowly confiscated from them by the government on an ongoing basis. It lasted for decades.
So is it that pace that allows them to get away with it?
Yes, and the pace can vary. The key, and we can get into more detail about how it's done, and it also ties into multiple other things that are going on right now in the world, is a concept called negative real interest rates.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
And that is, you have your stated interest rate, you have your nominal interest rate, and then you have a rate of inflation, which may be a quite different thing than the official rate of inflation.
Mm-hmm.
And the idea is that if the rate of inflation is higher than the interest payments that you're taking in, even on a pre-tax basis, then a saver is losing purchasing power every year. And remember, this is a zero-sum game, so to speak, between the borrower and the saver. You know, the saver is funding the borrower. So every dollar in purchasing power that the saver, that's you and I, are losing every year, that goes to the benefit of the borrower, which in this case is the federal government, at least for classic financial repression.
Dan, let's cover this in more detail because this is a really important point. I know that it's obfuscated constantly in the financial media. They talk about wealth as if it just magically appears in the stock market or just shows up. But really, money and debt and markers for that are really just markers for real wealth. And so what you're saying is that there's a fixed amount of real wealth that grows at a very fixed pace out there. That's our real rate of wealth creation. But then the rate of interest and the tax rates and other things that sort of get layered on around that could leave us in a position where our actual claim on that real wealth is shrinking by some percentage every year, right, in a negative sense. So when this is the part I want to get through, see if you can explain it better. I'm sure you can. It's wealth is just an accounting identity. So by definition, if one person is losing 3 or 4% a year, the only question to answer is who's gaining that 3 or 4% a year? It's just going from point A to point B. Is that accurate?
Yes, that's one way of phrasing it. And I'm glad you're bringing that up. You had pointed out that my background was one of being on the inside and being an investment banking mm-hmm. vice president and working with all these sorts of things. But I went into rebellion, so to speak, over 20 years ago because I strongly believed that the average retirement saver was essentially being fed a bill of goods. They're all being told they could simultaneously earn these 8 or 10% rates of return and have these rates of return exponentially compound to these fantastic levels. Even while the real rate of economic growth, what really matters was resources, goods and services, was growing at a far slower rate.
Right.
So these people behaved in a certain way. They saved a lot of money. That money went to the financial industry and the government, which enjoyed the benefits of that in real time. And now we're to this place, and it doesn't bring me pleasure to say it, but it's the place we've been heading the whole time, where we have this reconciliation going on between paper wealth and real wealth. And you have all these tens of millions of hardworking, good people who've been doing the right thing, and they've been deferring gratification, and they've been following the investment strategies they were supposed to. And now they're finding out they don't know if they're going to be able to retire, or what kind of standard of living they're going to be able to enjoy in retirement. And it comes right back to this issue that you were talking about, the difference between real wealth and paper wealth. And then the other thing that goes on beside that, there's every change in wealth is really a redistribution of wealth. And what's been going on, to add insult to injury, is not just the real wealth isn't there to support the, let's say, the retirements that people are hoping for, but quite a few of that has been redistributed from the retirement savers to the financial industry and the government in ways that are just complex enough, and financial repression is one of those ways, that the average voter or average saver never quite catches on.
Fantastic, Dan. Thank you so much for bringing it this way, because when people ask me, Chris, if you only had one chart, what would it be? And I'd show them a chart of aggregate debt accumulation and a total credit market debt as one line. And the second line on that chart is real GDP growth. And the debt is growing and compounding at a rate twice as fast as underlying, even nominal growth is growing faster, 3 or 4 percentage points faster than that. So I just look at that, and my eyebrows shoot up, and I say, how can you possibly be compounding the claims on wealth at twice the rate of the underlying rate of wealth accumulation? Doesn't anybody else see the problem? So thank you for seeing it. It seems as simple as that to me. Just eventually.
What are you calling it a problem for? It's a feature.
It's a feature.
That's how it's done. That's how the wealth is redistributed. And I've been writing about this for a number of years. The Fed's been engaged in what I call a liability-based bailout since at least 2007, where they're using controlling the amount and terms of liabilities to massively redistribute wealth from the average saver, not just to the government, but to the financial industry. But most people just don't think in those terms, so they don't really pick up on what's going on, and they do see this fantastic growth in debt as being this, how do you sustain it? This is leading a very bad place, so forth and so on. But what they're not seeing is that the whole time this is building up, there's a hand in their pocket that's picking out the contents of their wallet, and this is how it's being done.
So for all the people who particularly maybe, I don't care which side of the aisle they're on, but they're noting, oh my gosh, look at the debt problem of the United States. We're going to reframe that. We're going to call that a debt feature. And what happens with this accumulation of these liabilities, and you're just talking strict debt. We haven't even gotten to the unfunded liabilities and that stuff. So save that maybe for another time. But just the strict accumulation of debt, both at the government side and on in the private market side, that accumulation is a feature, and one of the features that comes with that, you're saying, is that the average saver ends up donating a large portion of their purchasing power towards that system.
Well, what financial repression does, and we're going to have to get around to going through a few more of the details there, but really what it does is it redistributes wealth from savers to borrowers. And I don't know about you, but I was raised with kind of a moral way of looking at money and economics, mm-hmm. which is you don't want debt. You don't want to be a borrower. You want to have assets that you're investing actually in other people's liabilities. What's a bank deposit? It's a liability of a financial corporation. Mm-hmm. What's an insurance policy? It's a liability of an insurance company. So what we're taught is that we are to be the ones who provide the assets that then become liabilities of other people. And people are just not aware how the central bank can set the situation up very intentionally where there is a redistribution of wealth with certain kinds of debt, not all kinds of debt, not most consumer debts. For instance, credit cards, this does not apply to in any way. But for certain kinds of debt that financial institutions and governments like to use, you have a steady annual flow of wealth the public doesn't see is going on that is steadily enriching the major corporations and the major banks.
All right, so here we are in the story. There's a period of financial liberalization. It's a big growth phase. Debts pile up, and then you have to enter a period of what's known as financial repression. It's well-studied. It's characterized. You can go get a degree in it. You could look it up on a website. It's a well-characterized thing. Let's talk about the actual mechanisms of financial repression so we have our listeners mm-hmm. have a real concrete understanding of exactly what this thing is. We know debts involved and liabilities, but help us really, how do we make this crisp?
Well, there was a very well-known article that was put out by a couple of scholars. Carmen Reinhart was the best known of them, that was carried by the National Bureau of Economic Research, and it's available on the International Monetary Fund website, and it's kind of an academic study of five different features of historical financial repression. And one of the things that I do in the article that's linked on your website is I take a much more intuitive and understandable look at how what these things are and how they work together. Mm-hmm. So people will understand what's actually going on as opposed to academic jargon.
Great.
And to understand financial repression, I think a central way of looking at it is you have to understand that we, the people, are more or less the sheep. And we need to be sheared every year in a way we don't understand. And if we start to not like being sheared every year, we start to understand what's going on, then as a matter of government policy, very deliberately, there need to be a series of fences set up. So participation is mandatory if you live in a nation. And to understand the shears, the two components of the shears are inflation and negative real interest rates. If you don't have inflation, if you're not steadily destroying the value of the money, then there is no fuel for financial repression. There is no redistribution of wealth. But what many people don't understand is that they're only worried about inflation if it's something big and bold, like 10% per year, 15% per year, 20% per year, something that's really obviously destroying wealth. But if you take a look at how governments actually use inflation over the longer term, the way you do it in a way that slowly, steadily redistributes massive sums of wealth, but nobody ever catches on and nobody gets voted out of office, is you use much more moderate rates of inflation. That can be 3%, 4%, 5%, 6%. That range works just fine for an extraordinary redistribution of wealth without, let's say, that water in the pot getting so hot that the frog catches on what's going on.
Mm-hmm.
So people think they're fine. You know, what are you talking about inflation for? I'm not worried about inflation. Well, that whole time, as long as people are thinking like that, that's perfect for the government. Now, the other half of the shears is having very low interest rates that create negative real interest rates. So if you have, let's say, money in a checking account right now or money in a savings account, and you are earning 0.25% per year, okay? And if we go on an official inflation rate, let's call that 2.25%, maybe somewhat less, somewhat more, depending on the country and the time, then each year you get 0.25% in income pre-tax. The purchasing power of your money loses 2.25%. You have a 2% negative real interest rate. So you're down 2%. It's a zero-sum transaction. The borrower is up 2%. And if you look at the post-war example, in the United States and the United Kingdom, between 1945 and the early 1970s, they actually used about a 3 to 4% negative real interest rate. Some nations like Australia and Italy were using more like 5%. And if we take a more reality-based inflation rate right now, which I would say is closer to 4 to 5%, maybe a little more, then we've got that full measure right there. We've got 4 to 5% annual loss in purchasing power for someone who's just keeping their money in cash, they're keeping it in a checking account, they're keeping it in a money market fund, whatever the case is. And that's uncomfortable, but it's not the kind of thing that's slapping you in the face every day and calling your attention to it like it would be if we're losing, let's say, 15% per year.
Right, but at 5%, if my math is right, roughly every 14 years I've lost half my purchasing power.
Yep.
Ouch.
Yeah. I mean, it's a steady process, but so much of politics and economics is it's not what it is, it's what people think it is, because that's what they base their behavior upon.
Yeah.
And that's kind of an ideal situation for a government. You're just a little bit patient. Every year that goes by, you're doing substantially better off. Every year that goes by, that you and your cronies are following some quite different ways of investing and making wealth than the general population has been told is good for them, then you're going to do a little bit better. Now, the other thing, and again, by the way, with interest rates, we used to have explicit controls on interest rates. For instance, you could not pay money, you could not have interest earnings in a checking account. Per Regulation Q, you were limited on the amount of money that would be paid out if you had a savings account. So that was very explicitly set up as a matter of statutory law that the interest rates that were being paid out and the instruments the public would invest in fact, did not keep up with the rate of inflation. And again, this is time. Happy days, Leave It to Beaver, and financial repression. They all went along together.
Now, hold on, Dan. So the Federal Reserve told me that they rammed interest rates all the way down to zero on the short end because they cared about unemployment and they wanted to stimulate the credit markets. When I hear the European ministers talk about the dangerously low rates of inflation, they're very, very worried about deflation as a concept. What you're saying is that the actual reasons that we have these interest rates is because they needed to get to negative interest rates. And the real fear of a deflationary environment is they don't know how to go below zero on interest rates yet. So So they don't have, like, that takes away one of their shears, doesn't it?
Well, there's levels within levels there, and we only have the time to go so far. But there is a complementary thing that's going on right now, and that is there's a great deal of concern among economists, and this is also devastating for investments over the longer term, that we may be in a area of secular stagnation, mm-hmm. is one of the terms that's used for it. The new mediocre is another term that's come out recently.
The new mediocre. All right.
Yep, what a name. From the head of the IMF, no less. But the concern is, well, how do you emerge from deep structural unemployment around the world that's no longer being counted in headline unemployment statistics because of changes in workforce participation rates? Well, the way you do that, conveniently enough, the major economists agree, is that you force negative real rates of return on savers. So conveniently enough, the exact mechanism for purportedly improving economies is the exact mechanism that redistributes wealth from savers to the government.
That's just a coincidence, I'm sure.
It's absolutely a coincidence, as well as all the different ways by using different techniques than what we are typically taught to do as investors, that this works strongly to the benefit of the major banks and big corporations.
Mm-hmm.
But anyway, let's talk about our fences.
Okay.
The first fence is funding by financial institutions. The deal is that most people don't directly lend money to the U.S. government, at least not anymore. You know, savings bonds used to be the most common way of doing it. That's what my dad did. You know, every month they'd take any extra savings they had, they'd buy a savings bond. You know, that's kind of what you were taught to do. But most of the public doesn't do that, and that's particularly true these days. So in order for the government debt to be funded, what they want to do is they want to force financial institutions effectively to fund the government. And how do the financial institutions do that? Well, they take in liabilities, they take in deposits from the general public. And because the financial institution is making much less money, that means they pay much lower rates to the people who are depositing their money with them. So by making financial institutions participate or encouraging them to participate, that means that everybody who has a deposit at a bank is participating in financial repression, even if they're never directly buying a treasury bill or anything like that. And a fascinating coincidence is something I have a couple of charts on in the article on my website.
Mm-hmm.
And these are from FRED II, Federal Reserve Bank of St. Louis. And what it does is they track the U.S. Treasury securities held by the Federal Reserve along with the excess reserves of depository institutions. And this gets into kind of the heart of how quantitative easing really works.
Mm-hmm.
And what's going on is, of course, the Federal Reserve is a central bank, can create money at will. And what they've been doing is they have been purchasing mortgages and securities from the banks in the United States, and they've been creating what are called excess asset reserves to pay for them, which is just newly created money. And then the bank is strongly encouraged to hold on to the excess asset reserve. And what has happened is that we now have about $2.4 trillion in U.S. Treasury securities that's held by the Federal Reserve, and that is funded by about $2.4 trillion that the banks have provided to the Federal Reserve that's being held as excess asset reserves. So when you look at those two charts, you're seeing an almost perfect picture of classic financial repression, where financial institutions provide the assets to the Federal Reserve, which then provides the assets to the U.S. government. And what happens effectively is that the Federal Reserve and the financial institutions are netted out, and you and I, through having money in a savings account or checking account, are funding the U.S. government at effectively a 0% return.
So that comes full circle. So we are the sheep that are then effectively funding the rates of return that are so low that we mm-hmm. are in negative territory. So we're funding.
We have no idea. We have no idea that we're funding the federal government, because we've heard this term probably for most people, quantitative easing. We have no idea what it means. It sounds really technical. All we know is we've got our money at the bank. Well, if we have our money at the bank has their money at the Federal Reserve. The Federal Reserve is funding the U.S. Treasury. Those two intermediates drop out, and we're the ones who are funding the U.S. government. Now, there's a couple other types of classic capital controls. One of them is we used to live between the mid-40s and the early 70s of pervasive capital controls. It used to be very difficult to move your money from one country to another. And then that got really easy to do for quite a while, but it no longer is. And I don't know if you've discussed FATCA with your readers before. I assume you have.
We have, and I believe that was, wasn't that tucked into the Affordable Care Act?
It was. It was part of this massive package that nobody really talked about. Okay.
Right.
Most people have no idea.
And just so everybody remembers, FATCA is this act that forces foreign institutions to have to cough up information about U.S. investors. It's very onerous, and many foreign institutions have decided to not participate and interact with U.S. customers anymore. And this was nominally so that we could track tax cheats was the idea.
Yeah, and it's got a great big stick involved with it, too, when it comes to foreign financial institutions, where most of them around the world, unless they have major U.S. operations, are quite logically declining to participate, which I would argue might have been the U.S. government's goal in the first place. They basically have to, anytime the IRS says jump, say how high. So if you're a financial institution anywhere else in the world, you're almost obligated now to keep an eye on the U.S. Internal Revenue Service and U.S. laws, or you could get hit with devastating sanctions, which have to do with punitive tax rates being put on any investments that you have in the United States.
Mm-hmm.
So around the world, what financial institutions are quite logically making one of two choices. One of them is they're refusing to take deposits or any form of investment from U.S. investors, which is really wreaking some havoc with expatriates living overseas right now. They're getting their checking accounts shut down and so forth. And simultaneously, for those institutions that are deeply part of the U.S. markets and are willing to do this, the IRS now has the best information they've had. But either way, it reduces the ability of money to flow outside of the pasture, so to speak, to leave the shearing. Now, there is a fifth component as well, and again, you know, it's funny, you hear about this, and people think you're talking conspiracy theory again. No, this is how the world worked between 1933 and 1974, and that was having controls on the investment ownership of precious metals.
Mm-hmm.
Because if you have ongoing inflation that you can't get compensation for in a bank account, there'll be a tremendous temptation to do this through holding precious metals. And it used to be that it was just flat out forbidden for all those years, at least in the United States and the United Kingdom. And these days we have a punitive collectibles tax treatment.
Right.
I mean, if we look at inflation taxes and so forth, it really is just confiscating wealth on an ongoing basis. And I've got articles on that on my website, even though many precious metals investors are not aware of this.
Mm-hmm. Yep, collectibles. It's just good precious metals, just collectibles, subject to a 28% gains rate, unless they've shifted that.
Yep. So as you try to keep up with inflation, that's kind of like a ball and chain that keeps dragging down to the financial benefit of the federal government.
So you're talking about fencing the average investors. And I assume if you're a very sophisticated institution, you can dodge FATCA and you can invest in all the Italian bonds you want at a positive real rate or whatever. But for the average person, you have to deal with these financial intermediaries. That's fence number one. Then number two, you are stuck inside your country because of FATCA. And then number three, there's some shenanigans going on with precious metals and keeping those all well contained and by whatever hook or crook, just to make sure that people understand that that's not where you want to be either. So if you have all those three things running, what's left? Well, you're in a bank, you're in a 401k, you're in a money market fund, you're in all the traditional instruments that have been marketed to us and saying, this is where you invest, this is how you get wealthy. And you're arguing that's just a holding pen.
Yes, where you very deliberately receive, as a matter of U.S. government and Federal Reserve policy, a very low interest rate, which flows to the direct benefit of the U.S. government as well as corporations and banks that are engaged in asset liability management. Mm. And that's what financial repression really is. It's a redistribution of wealth from those who are not engaged in asset liability management to those who are.
Fascinating. Well said. So this sounds, you're saying this is a systematic program. It's well described. It's been operating. It hasn't been operating for a while, or did it really just start to kick into high gear or a higher gear in 2008?
Well, 2008 and 2009 was a time of shifting. I think the central banks and the governments really did get caught flat-footed. They were trying to survive. But all the classic components of financial repression, with the exception of precious metals, kind of simultaneously emerged in 2010. That was when quantitative easing 2, which was radically different from quantitative easing 1, first came into effect. And that's effectively, I wrote about it in real time, it was happening. I think that the media didn't take that approach at all. What quantitative easing 2 was really about from the very beginning was the Federal Reserve took full control of all U.S. interest rates. That happened simultaneously with FATCA being passed, and simultaneous with that is when interest rates went down to effectively 0%. So you had the emergence of 0% interest rates, you had full government control of interest rates, you had a negative real rate of return, and you had FATCA putting a fence up around, even as, of course, the other thing that was going on because of QE2 or quantitative easing, too, is you had that money, that fantastic flow of money coming in that, again, can be seen on the graphs in the article in 2010. So all those components came together.
Yeah. All right. So it looks like they were caught flat-footed. What you're describing was an emergency acceleration of a financial repression program. Like that sounds very sudden and rapid. And to take interest rates, which pre-crisis, I believe we were in the, what were we on the 10-year? 5.5%, 6%, somewhere in that zone. And to drive that down to, say, 2%. That's really extraordinary. And they did that very rapidly. So was there
And they did that simultaneously with a fantastic increase in excess asset reserves. That's where they got the money to do it from.
Yeah.
So the two were working hand in hand simultaneously. And again, there's nothing controversial about this. If you're a professional economist, if you understand these principles well, then okay, maybe it's time to bring quantitative easing out of the closet again. We hadn't used it in about 40 years, but all of a sudden, 1, 2, 3, they're all there.
Well, and let's put number 4 in. 2011, the precious metals peaked and have been just absolutely clubbed silly ever since then. They really don't look like an appropriate place to store any of your wealth. But of course, China and India have said, thank you very much. We'll accelerate our purchases of this now cheaper commodity that we happen to love. Your thoughts on that dynamic?
Well, yeah, another feature of financial repression that we don't talk about much anymore, I don't know if you're familiar with the London Gold Pool.
Yes. Yep.
This operated from the early 1960s to about 1970 or so. And the issue was that gold was illegal, but people were still investing in it, trying to beat inflation. And they were trying to get their money out of the country and so forth to buy gold.
Yep.
And what I think is a fascinating historical footnote that gives you a good insight into the times is, I don't know if you like the early James Bond movies, but Goldfinger is a classic.
Yeah, that's a good one.
And who was this horrible villain who was, you know, fighting this very youthful James Bond and so forth? Well, he was somebody who was trying to get investment gold out of the UK and into Switzerland. That was a crime against society at the time.
Evil.
That was
evil.
Enough to bring James Bond on. And what the London Gold Pool was the United States, and I believe it was 7 other major nations. There still was, for institutions and so forth, a functioning gold market in London. And every time that countries, that investors would say, okay, the U.S., because at the time, the Bretton Woods monetary system was in place, where all the other currencies were pegged to the U.S. dollar, and the U.S. dollar itself was pegged to gold. So they were basically speculating against the purchasing power of the currencies and saying there's going to be future inflation, you're borrowing all this money from the Vietnam War and so forth, and we're going to invest in gold and earn an arbitrage profit. Only every time they did that, and again, this is not conspiracy theory, this is history, the big nations would come in periodically and they would use their financial resources and they would take over the gold market and they would wreak havoc on speculators who were betting against them.
Mm-hmm.
And it worked.
Mm-hmm.
Because every time you'd start, you thought you had an easy game, you thought, okay, there's inflation, this isn't being reflected, I'm just going to buy gold, I'll do fine, gold has nowhere to go but up. Every now and then, the U.S. government and others would come into the markets and do everything they could to create a situation where you would get financially wiped out as a speculator, as a deliberate matter of policy, and then come back years later. Now, has that actually been happening since 2011? Well, you know, if you look at some of the stuff that happened in the silver's market and the changing margin requirements and so forth,
mm-hmm.
maybe it was. I can't say for sure, but the results are kind of compatible with that.
Right, so maybe this is another amazing coincidence. We've had some nice coincidences, but they all line up for the average person. It's been extraordinarily difficult since 2010 to leave this fenced-in area.
Yeah, exactly.
Whether it was just accidental coincidence or whatnot, but it all lined up to, if you were going to write a Goldfinger 2, but about financial repression, you were going to write a plot line, this would be almost unbelievably convenient. It worked beautifully. So yep. Here we are. But this all sounds rather hopeless at this point, you know. So they've created the institutions and government want to have created this fenced in area, put people in it, and said we're going to run this as long as we have to until, you know, we get our debts back under control. Is there a way for people to leave the flock in this analogy?
Well, that's an educational area that I've been working with for some time now. And that is trying to show people through tutorials and things like that, maybe a very different way of looking at money and assets and liabilities and how the redistribution of wealth works and so forth. And that is that, you know, I do believe there is a strong case to be made in some cases for individuals to be engaging in asset liability management strategies.
Fantastic. I don't want you to give away your work, because I know that this is an area where you do a lot of education for people, and I think that's fantastic. What I want to hear you say is, yeah, there are ways to dodge this in the way that the system has been running, and I believe you have a way to show people.
There absolutely is, but it requires a paradigm change.
Okay. A paradigm change in a person's thinking or in the system itself?
Yeah, I would say so. In, a change in how we have been taught to be the sheep, more or less.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And it takes a paradigm change to stop being a sheep and to start taking advantage of some of the same flows of wealth that the governments and major investors are.
All right. So let me ask you this then. I think there's a potential wrinkle in their issue. So you talked about the period post-war, you know, up through the Leave It to Beaver stage, and we've gone through a couple of cycles. Something that's mm-hmm. been true in prior cycles has, and use this word, is very important, resources, in particular energy. We had a increasing available net energy per capita up to about 1970, and then that started to nose over because population and oil growth were, you know, population was suddenly faster than actual oil growth. We're at a place now where the Federal Reserve, the government, the Bank of England, ECB, all of them have been on this program of financial repression, but with their fingers crossed, double fingers crossed, saying, this works, and it works a lot better if we get our growth back. What happens to the mm-hmm. financial repression model if growth doesn't return as it has in the past? What if we're in this structural, what was the term you used before? I forgot. It was great.
Secular stagnation.
Secular stagnation, but there was that
it's
other
kind
one.
Of the buzzword among economists.
That Lagarde used. You said the head of the IMF had another one. It was great. I forgot it.
The new mediocre.
Yeah, the new mediocre. What if we're in this new mediocre, and that's just reality for a variety of complex issues that could be related to available net energy from resources and population, who knows, right? But if we're in this new mediocre, does financial repression work, or does it not work? Does it break? Does it get worse for us? Do you have a sense of that yet?
Well, it doesn't work by itself. And that's the issue, too. And again, this is an area I've been exploring for quite a while now. The issue is we have an aging population mm-hmm. in the West. We already have heavily indebted governments. If you look at how government debt was dropped from over 90% of GDP on average for the West to under 30%, this was happening in a time of rapid population growth, but as you say, it was also we had rapid energy growth at the very same time. We had an economic boom going on that was very helpful in hoping to reduce the issue. Now, it's just the reverse right now, because as we look out over time, what we know is that each year these populations are on average getting a little bit older, and each year the governments are likely to become a little bit more indebted. The flow is really going the opposite direction there. So then we need to take, I think, what is a broader look at financial repression. And I should probably put a link up. I wrote another article on that back in 2011 that I called the second edge of modern financial repression. And one of the things I think that they have to do, and they're already doing it, and they've been doing it since 2010, is you also need to force negative rates of return on those who are relying on private and public retirement promises. So the only way that you can beat it, if you have a rising level of expenditures with an aging population, all of whom have the Medicare promises made to them and so forth, is that you have to make sure that benefits do not keep up with the rate of inflation. What's happened with Social Security benefits over the last 4 years?
Right.
They haven't remotely even kept up with the official rate of inflation, let alone the real rate of inflation. So there's multiple factors in play there, each one of which, though, tends to work to the financial disadvantage of the average person in a way that's just subtle enough where it doesn't become a campaign issue.
Right, except that in certain cases, we're starting to see at the municipal and state levels that they're starting to openly explore the idea of breaking those pension promises quite openly, which probably won't be that popular, I'm guessing. But they're stuck.
No, but
they're stuck in the same mathematical squeeze. Like they've made promises that were accruing at a much faster rate than their underlying contributions, which is, you know, the municipal equivalent of saying we're gonna grow our collective credit market debt at twice the rate of the national GDP. Either way, the promises are accumulating faster than the substance, however that gets paid off. So those break at some point. And my question then is around financial repression. Financial repression is designed to take the overt debt liabilities of a nation and start to work those down in a reasonable way. But you're saying that you know, the only real way you can sort of tinker with that at the unfunded liability side is through maneuvering the COLA adjustments, for instance, on Social Security at a lower rate than the real rate of inflation. That tends to sort of work it down a little bit. But still, that buys you some time. I guess my question is, mm-hmm. can it really fix it? And I don't understand mathematically how it could, unless the accrual rate of the liability growth is being more than offset by the rate at which you're declining the actual payouts the distributions towards the liability side of that. Does that make sense?
Yeah. What I would say is that we have some enormous problems, and everything is interrelated. Financial repression is not a magic bullet that solves everything for the governments, but it is a essential tool of financial survival. Because if they don't have financial repression, then that makes the other problems that much worse, and they arrive that much sooner. Yeah. But really, everything is interconnected there. And the other thing that I think people don't really fully take into account is that when we look at the off-balance sheet promises that the government has entered into, you know, that they need that very special governmental accounting not to include them in the deficit. If a private company did that or individual, they'd go to prison for using governmental accounting. But they're not taking that stuff into account. And the issue is, even those shortfalls that we're seeing are based upon normal economic growth.
Right.
Is what's baked Great into point. The government. And if we take the intersection between secular stagnation and these retirement promises, and then we add financial repression on top of that, nothing works anymore from a conventional investment perspective. You don't have the growth for a return on equity investments. You don't have the interest payments you're supposed to be able to rely on to live on in retirement. And, you know, what does the investor do?
Well, now that is the $64,000 question right there.
It is indeed.
Because when I take this to its logical conclusion, And this involves a little bit of what I understand about how humans work, a little bit of history saying that this has been done again and again, is that those in power preserve the status quo. And for them, that means just continuing to do what they did, which is to accumulate more debt. So the government will continue to spend. The Federal Reserve will make sure that the government's at least borrowing at a rate sufficient to offset borrowing that's not happening in the private sector. At any rate, we continue this great debt binge, which is really, debt's just a claim on money to me, and it's a claim on future money. So we keep hoping the future is going to be bigger when we get there. The new malaise sort of stalks you for a while, and eventually people come to their senses and go, it's not coming. It's not coming in time. And now these debts are too large and they have to be written down in some fashion. And there I can only think of two ways to do that. One is through a process of default and one is through overinflation. I'm not sure that financial repression works once people come to their senses and go, hey, this doesn't pencil out. No matter how much you repress this thing, it doesn't do the trick. We're going to need more. And then the only question is to figure out who's going to eat the losses.
Yep, the real losses that must be there. And money itself, I think, and debt is much more flexible than most people give it credit for if you look at it from the perspective of a government or a central bank. But it all boils down to that question that we started with today, and that is the discrepancy between paper wealth or paper retirement promises that have been made and the amount of real resources that are available.
Yeah.
And if the real resources aren't there, there's no way that you're going to be able to make the promises.
That's it. That's the conclusion I get to. And of course, I think there's a lot of territory time between here and there. And so then it gets down to the question of how do we navigate this space? But my opening gambit is that traditional investing, as it's been sold to us, is basically the equivalent of sitting down at a card table in Texas and not knowing who the patsy is at the table. It's you. Right. I truly believe that Wall Street mm-hmm. takes what it takes on a consistent basis. Its billions are just taken off the top. It's like, I don't know if you saw Wolf in Wall Street, but there's a great scene, Leonardo DiCaprio sitting on one side, Matthew McConaughey on the other, and he just basically says, Matthew McConaughey's training him, and he says, look, we take cash home at the end of every day. Your job is to keep the people who are playing here fully invested at all times. Keep the dream alive, but they don't take it home, right? So that's kind of one of the jaded views I have of Wall Street. They're there to do their siphoning job. They do it great, great job, fantastic at it. But well, the question comes down to this: what does the average investor really do? And you're saying there is a program of education, you've got a way, a paradigm shift that they can begin to explore. Part of my view has been to tell people that there's a wealth transfer coming that could be rather dramatic, like we've seen in the past when the claims and the real stuff get out of balance. Eventually, they rebalance. We call them wealth destructions historically, but they're not. They're wealth transfers. Mm-hmm. And you can either be on the right side or the wrong side of that wealth transfer. Typically on the right side, it's hard assets, not just gold and silver, but it's productive assets, productive land, productive this, you name it. It's primary, secondary forms of wealth. Be there as much as you possibly can, knowing that stuff never goes to zero, and just hold on to it as best you can. But for people who are fully in the paper markets, I'm concerned, Dan. I'm concerned mm-hmm. because I believe that they are running extraordinary risks, and they could wake up one day and discover the rules have been changed, the markets have been closed, my capital won't move anymore, you name it, right? There's just lots of ways that you know better mm-hmm. than I, that the system can completely sort of freeze you out. And then, like in mm-hmm. Argentina, you know, 2001, people woke up one day, like, my bank account is closed. I have American dollars in there. 2 weeks later, I have the same number in there, but they're pesos. Hey, 30% haircut. Ouch, right? So these are the sorts of things that I see coming, and I'm wondering if that's sort of, if you have a different view on that.
Well, I've been kind of, I guess you could say in many ways, heading in that direction for the last 20 years in terms of looking at the discrepancy between the exponential growth rate of paper wealth and the growth rate of real wealth, even with normal economic growth. And now we have further problems in terms of stagnation and so forth.
Mm-hmm.
But the other thing to recognize is there's always levels within levels. And whenever we say there has been a destruction of wealth, that if, like you're saying, there's a transfer of wealth, I call it a redistribution of wealth. In any one of these scenarios, whether we're looking at ongoing long-term financial repression, whether we are looking at long-term economic stagnation, whether we are looking at financial crisis, whether we look at financial crisis that is in fact created as the result of 0% interest rates leading to market bubbles. Every single one of those is a redistribution of wealth.
Well said.
And for me, that's the key, is looking at each one of those situations and saying, okay, people are getting hurt here, people are getting wiped out here, how do I keep that from happening to me? How do I position myself so the wealth is being distributed towards me instead of away from me? And it's just a perspective.
Fantastic.
We're looking at things.
Yeah, well said. I think that's very clear and well said. And I could talk with you forever around this, and I know there's much more to cover. We're at the end of our time here. So I want to thank you very much. I want to direct people to your website, which is Daniel Ammerman, all put together, DanielAmmerman.com, A-M-E-R-M-A-N, Daniel Ammerman. And Dan, is there any other place that people should go to follow you, or do you have any events coming up you'd like to tell us about?
Probably the website is the best place to start.
Yep.
But yeah, I've thoroughly enjoyed our conversation. Thank you, Chris.
Well, thank you. The pleasure's been mine, and I hope we can go deeper on some of these things, because getting the education out around this and making sure people understand what's happening, I think, is really the only defense to figuring out, or it's the only way to go about figuring out what your offense is going to be, so that you can defend yourself, because these are crazy times, and this stuff has been cooking for a while, but boy, it's sure fascinating now.
It is indeed. There's just no substitute for knowledge.
Information is the new money. It's very important. So, Dan, thank you so much for your time today.
Thank you, Chris.